Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar. More than 120 people died as the result of domestic violence in Pennsylvania last year. 67% of those victims were killed by a current or former intimate partner, and most often a firearm was used. October is Domestic Violence Awareness Month, a time to educate about domestic violence, but also an opportunity to talk about prevention. Joining us on today's program is Susan Higginbotham, who is CEO of the Pennsylvania Coalition Against Domestic Violence. Ms. Higginbotham, good to see you again.
Thank you, Scott, for having me on the show again.
I really appreciate the opportunity.
If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can leave a question or a comment on WITF's Facebook page, on Twitter. We are at SmartTalkWITF. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. You know, I ask this question often when we have an awareness campaign. October, there are a lot of awareness campaigns. It's kind of hard to stick out. But this is one that should get many people's attention. What's the message that you and others want to get out to the public during Domestic Violence Awareness Month?
Well, I think for those of us who are doing the work, we find it important to raise awareness about the public health problem that intimate partner violence is and how pervasive it is, and as well as how it impacts all kinds of communities, regardless of background, status, socioeconomic situations. It's an equal opportunity problem.
But you just said the problem of intimate partner. Mm-hmm. Now, I just saw the statistics that says 67% are from the domestic violence occurs when there is an intimate partner involved. So
sure.
why did you say intimate partner rather than just, you know, because that leaves another 33%.
Oh, well, I mean, the larger category would be family violence.
Right.
And so there's intimate partner violence, and then there's family violence, you know, within homes and within families. And so all of those things exist at the same time.
And that pretty much is a definition of domestic violence, that this is one of those crimes that is committed when the victim knows the perpetrator.
Exactly.
But something else that sticks out is, and you kind of touched on it, but I would like to talk about a little bit more. One of the aspects of domestic violence is that there is no typical domestic violence victim, is there?
Well, when you're talking about individuals, no. There's no typical individual who, you know, may be victimized. As I said, it's a public health problem, and it's recognized as such. And really what it's going to take is a cultural change.
When you say a public health problem, what do you mean by that?
Well, the impact on the community and individuals. Trauma has a huge impact on individuals, and it causes all kinds of impacts such as harm, people having to go to the emergency room. Psychological abuse is a huge problem. You know, perpetrators use coercion, fear, violence, you know, in order to control victims and survivors. Mm-hmm. And so it creates all kinds of impacts on society in terms of families, workplaces, economics. I mean, it's estimated that more than 10 million people each year are abused in the United States. And just in Pennsylvania, it's estimated that the lifetime economic burden of intimate partner violence is akin to $156 billion in terms of impact.
That's just in Pennsylvania?
Yes. Mm.
You know, even though there may not be a typical victim, there are statistics. Who are victims most often? Then I'm going to ask, who are abusers most often?
Well, I think that's really hard to say who the victims and perpetrators are. We can talk about characteristics. So, you know, perpetrators of domestic violence often share similar tactics, as I mentioned before, threats, fear, coercion, use of psychological and verbal abuse, which really lays the groundwork. So sometimes people think that domestic violence is only about physical violence, and that's not the case. There are other, you know, forms of abuse, such as psychological and verbal abuse, that really wreak havoc on families and on individuals.
Most often women, who are the victims?
Well, I mean, the statistics show that 1 in 4 women and 1 in 7 men will be victims of intimate partner violence in their lifetimes. So there are all kinds of individuals and people from marginalized communities, such as transgender folks, LGBT people. And what we know in addition to that is that groups who are marginalized in communities, such as immigrants, people of color, elderly folks, though that marginalization serves to compound the impact of domestic violence.
Are there trends? I mean, during this month, and I hate to think that we only take a look, I say we, media most often, sure, only take a look during the month of October, but are there trends? You mentioned 10 million cases of domestic violence across the country. More, less, being reported more often, what?
Well, I think that over time in the movement, we've been able to help raise awareness. And so I think that there are more people potentially seeking out services. So, you know, there's that. I really think that in terms of cultural issues, we're always going to need to have direct services. And, you know, we are a network. The coalition is a network of 59 programs that serve all 67 counties in Pennsylvania. We're always going to need hotline services and emergency shelter and counseling and supportive services. But the real key to doing something about intimate partner violence is prevention and cultural change. And those, you know, cultural change is like moving mountains. But it means doing things like bystander training. Because, you know, in the past, people have thought that intimate partner violence was just something that happened in certain families and behind closed doors, and nobody else really had, you know, any responsibility for it. And we're saying that that's not the case, that as a society, we need to do something about not tolerating intimate partner violence.
Well, and it's something that wasn't talked about publicly very often. I mean, and that's why an awareness campaign is so important, that maybe it does bring some people out who have been the victims or have witnessed it or know of someone that has been the victim, that they will come out and talk about it, whether it's with a professional or even a family member, a friend, something like that, that someone who has kept it quiet. Right. So you say those cultural changes are like moving mountains. Have the mountains started to erode somewhat?
Well, you know, we're making some gains. And you mentioned just raising awareness in October. And, of course, we work year-round to
raise awareness.
Right. But,
yeah, it's not like you shut down the other 11 months of the
right.
year.
Well, and this year for Domestic Violence Awareness Month, again, we're going to hold our annual event at the Capitol on Monday, this coming Monday, the 21st, and we'll commemorate the 122 victims who lost their lives in Pennsylvania last year due to domestic violence. While we're there, Senator Tom Killian and Representative Cheryl DeLosier will introduce resolutions acknowledging October's Domestic Violence Awareness Month. And this year, our keynote speaker is Second Lady Gisele Fetterman, who will focus on the importance of healthy relationships and prevention of violence. So that's really our theme this year. And also next week, in conjunction with the ceremony, the Capitol lights will turn purple for the week to in recognition of Domestic Violence Awareness Month.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. By the way, coming up a little later in the program, we're going to be talking about Opportunity Zones. It's a program that came about with the 2017 federal tax overhaul to help cities, not just cities, but really any kind of areas that have been financially distressed with private investment. There were like 300 identified here in Pennsylvania. That's coming up a little bit later in the program. October is Domestic Violence Awareness Month, and we're speaking with Susan Susan Higginbotham, CEO of the Pennsylvania Coalition Against Domestic Violence. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. We were just talking about trends and changing the culture. One of the things that I think is just an observation is that law enforcement has changed their thinking. Not that they didn't take domestic violence seriously before, but I think that very often it would be looked upon, and this wasn't just police, but by a lot of people, that this was a family situation and that you can work it out amongst yourselves. We'll do what we can. We'll put you over in this corner, put him over here, and let's work it out. That is not the case always today, that law enforcement are taking this much more seriously than maybe what they used to.
Well, yes, and folks, our colleagues who work in law enforcement recognize that these are often very volatile situations that are dangerous. And we've got a program in Pennsylvania called the Lethality Assessment Program. There's information on our website about that. But it's not in every county yet, but we are working with law enforcement and local domestic violence programs to implement the LAP program. And what it's designed to do is to assist law enforcement in being able to screen and identify the most potentially lethal situations so that they can link the victim to a local domestic violence program for services and also, you know, just help get that person to safety.
That has to be kind of frightening, more than kind of. Sure. Very frightening for someone when a police officer says, you know, under this assessment program, we can see that there's a possibility, the potential here, right, for you to be killed.
Well, it's an opportunity, is what it is to help someone get to safety and to be able to access services. And, you know, one of the things I wanted to mention, Scott, is for anybody who is dealing right now with a domestic violence situation, they can go to our website at pcadv.org and type in their zip code or their town and find the local domestic violence program that can help them.
Mm-hmm. You wanted to mention, we only have a few minutes left, so
sure,
I want to make sure you have an opportunity to talk about that. Legislation. Mm-hmm. What kind of legislation is there right now in Harrisburg?
Sure. Well, right now we don't have a signature piece of legislation, but last year we had some real success with Act 79, which amended the Protection from Abuse Act. Now there is mandatory relinquishment in all final protection from abuse orders. Those individuals have to turn their guns over within 24 hours. And they can no longer give weapons to a family member or a friend down the street. So while we wish it had gone a little farther, it's a huge step in the right direction. Right now, we're working on a number of issues related to housing, because housing is a major issue for people who need to get to safety. And so we don't have a specific piece of legislation yet, but we're really working on that. And then the other thing is we're invested in making sure that the local domestic violence programs have more funding to be able to expand services and reach more into the community.
Well, when you're talking about housing, mm-hmm, I assume you're talking about permanent housing, mm-hmm, that, finding a place for the victims of domestic abuse. What about those in emergency situations?
Sure.
There are shelters. There are places,
right,
where victims can go.
Mm-hmm.
But how do they find out about it, and how do they make the decision to do that?
Well, this is what the local domestic violence programs are adept at. So when somebody who's dealing with domestic violence reaches out to their local domestic violence program through their hotline, then there's a screening that occurs to help identify, the needs of the person calling. And if there's a need for emergency housing, there are a number of different ways to handle that. There's emergency shelter. There's what's called rapid resettlement, relocation. There's transitional housing. So there's a number of different options for safety But then, of course, long term, people need, you know, permanent housing, as you said. And so that's an issue, you know, that's throughout the state. And so it's a project that PCADV is working on. We have a senior housing specialist who helps advise the local programs on how to address these issues and to support them in their work.
And I'm jumping around a little bit on
sure.
you, but I wanted to bring this out. It was reported this year that the majority of mass shooters, mm-hmm. obviously there were unfortunately several occasions where there were mass shooters throughout the country, that the majority of mass shooters had domestic violence in their background. Now, that's not to say that every abuser will become a mass murderer or anything like that. But what it does show is that violence can lead to more violence and sometimes even extreme violence.
That's right, Scott. Well, listen, people should understand that all violence is linked. And so it's not surprising to us when we saw the research that came out that said that mass shooters, you know, often the majority have a history of domestic violence. Because think about it this way. If you're willing to harm your intimate partner or your family members, it's easy to think about harming strangers. And so, you know, these are people who, again, use threats, use coercion, use fear, and use weapons to really terrorize people.
And quite frankly, I mean, we had Sue Klebold on, the mother of Dylan Klebold of Columbine, mm-hmm. Just a few weeks ago. And one of the things she pointed out that sometimes these mass shootings are really suicides and, you know,
murder suicides.
Right. And, you know, that's one of the things that can happen. One of the things that when we talk about cultural changes, that we're hearing more often is about talking to young men and boys, mm-hmm. especially by their parents as they're growing up,
sure.
about, you know, how they should treat people.
Healthy relationships.
That's talk it. About that.
Sure. Well, we have a program at PCADV that we call Engaging Men and Boys. And it's really about the fact that men are fathers, uncles, brothers, caretakers, professors, mentors, and there are so many men who are positive role models, and we really want to amplify that. They can help set the example for what it means to be a man and to challenge toxic masculinity. And so this year we expanded our Father's Day focus to hashtag Hear Me Out, because not all men are fathers. And we wanted to be more inclusive about that, and it was very successful. In fact, Governor Wolf and Lieutenant Governor Fetterman joined the Hear Me Out Challenge. They created a video that went viral on social media. And so we're so grateful for the role models who helped to promote that and to show that men have a role in ending domestic violence.
We only have about 2 minutes left. I want to thank you very much for being with us today. I want to ask this question, but I have a question that about the resources to finish this segment of the program. A caller, and I have to say that this comes up every time, wants to know how you address false accusations.
Well, there's no evidence that there's a plethora of false accusations. I think that that's part of the cultural change that we need to make. We need to believe survivors. We need to not minimize. And I think sometimes perpetrators create this illusion that there are victims out there, you know, making false accusations, and there's no evidence of it.
When you say no evidence, I mean, I'm sure there has mm-hmm. been a nasty divorce where...
Oh, sure. I'm talking about...
It happens infrequently.
You know, I'm talking about population-wide.
Right. Okay.
So it would be it's very rare for survivors to try to manipulate the system by making false accusations.
Final word on resources. Mm-hmm. If we have someone listening today who may be in an abusive relationship, may know someone, what could they do?
Well, just the fact that help is available. You know, in Pennsylvania, there in every county, all 67 counties, there are domestic violence services available. And as I said earlier on, folks can go to pcadv.org, type in their zip code, their town, and the resource will come up for the domestic violence program in their area. And how they can reach safety.
Susan Higginbotham is the CEO of the Pennsylvania Coalition Against Domestic Violence. Thank you very much for being with us
today.
Thank
you, Scott.
And the important work that you do.
Thank you.
WITF, in partnership with State Impact Pennsylvania, will host a local retro report discussion from invasive species to the TMI shutdown. Some of Pennsylvania's top environmental headlines have roots in historical events. Join me next Wednesday, October 23rd, from 6 to 7:30 p.m. at the WITF Public Media Center as I host a retro report screening and panel discussion. We'll talk about climate change, invasive species, water quality, and more. Register to attend at WITF.org/events. Welcome back to Smart Talk. As part of the 2017 federal tax overhaul, federal lawmakers created tax incentives called Opportunity Zones, with the stated aim of spurring investment in distressed communities. Individuals and businesses can defer and reduce their capital gains taxes by putting their profits on other investments towards projects, properties, and businesses in certain low-income U.S. Census tracts. About 300 places were designated as Opportunity Zones in Pennsylvania by the Wolf Administration. Are the Opportunity Zones working to create investment in communities that need it? We have two journalists with us today who have recently reported on Opportunity Zones. Joining us is Charlotte Keith. She is with Spotlight PA, an independent nonpartisan newsroom powered by the Philadelphia Inquirer, and has media partners throughout the state. Also, Ed Mahan reports for PA Post. PA Post is a statewide news digital-first organization operated by WITF. Charlotte and Ed, welcome to the program.
Great to be here.
Thanks for having us.
All right. When I listen to something that President Trump said, he's been touting Opportunity Zones for some time now. And let's listen to something he said a few months ago.
With Opportunity Zones, we're drawing investment into neglected and underserved communities of America so that all Americans, regardless of zip code, have access to the American dream.
Charlotte, I explained what Opportunity Zones are, but a little more explanation. What is an opportunity zone?
Well, it's basically a poor census tract that's been specially chosen so that investment there is eligible for these very lucrative tax breaks.
Mm-hmm. What's the thinking behind the tax incentive?
Well, the idea is to give wealthy investors a particular incentive to put their money into these poor communities. Say you make money selling stock. Normally, you'd have to pay a lot of tax on that. But if you invest in an opportunity zone, you can reduce your taxes and ultimately pay no federal taxes on the investment itself after 10 years.
Mm-hmm. So how are they different than other tax incentives?
Well, one big difference is the lack of regulation. There are certain sin businesses that you're not allowed to invest in, but other than that, it's pretty wide open and it's very investor-driven. So investors can put their money into what they want, where they want. It's also different in that there's no public reporting requirement. It's not like there's a list that you can look up somewhere of all the investments that have been made under this program, because it's done through the tax code. And so it has less transparency, I would say, than a lot of other economic incentive programs.
Okay, you just said less transparency, but my next question is, why is that a problem? It would seem to be make sense that the federal government would want to be able to follow where the money went, how it's being spent.
It's a problem because it makes it harder to know if it's working or not. I think, you know, Ed and I both in our reporting on this, the way that you find out about investments that have taken advantage of this is by word of mouth, by, you know, some public statements. But it's not like there's a kind of master database somewhere. And that would certainly be really helpful going forward in figuring out, you know, is this doing what it promised?
And yeah, we heard from some people in Erie that there are some investors who specifically don't want their information publicized, that they're doing opportunity zone investment. Maybe they just don't want the attention, or maybe they think it puts them at a competitive disadvantage if they're going to like throw a bunch of money into a project in a certain area. They don't want competitors to know about that.
But there, I think that there has been a lot of discussion around having more disclosure and more transparency. And it's something I think people kind of both who are skeptical of the program and people who are supporters sometimes are in favor of, because it puts a big caveat on any attempt to say, you know, how successful is this, when the way that you have to find out about it is kind of very sporadic and kind of hit and miss.
And it actually is more of a private-public partnership than it is going to the Treasury and providing taxpayer money.
And I mean, you get a big you get a big tax break. I mean, and that's a big tax cut and on your money, which is different than a lot of other tax programs. And that's sort of what a lot of people like about the program as well, why they think it does have potential to be stronger than some other economic development tools.
Mm-hmm. All right, so let's talk about its success. Charlotte, you talked with a number of different places that are utilizing Opportunity Zones. A lot has been made about the potential benefits. We heard President Trump talking about it at the beginning of the program. Is it living up to its promise?
Well, based on my reporting, I would say not really. And that comes with the caveat that we spoke about, that, you know, it's not possible to track comprehensively, and also that it is still early on in the program's life cycle. But what I found from talking to people all across the state about this, you know, local leaders, economic development officials, is that a lot of the places that are benefiting from this are places that were already doing pretty well. And some of the projects that are using the tax incentive were projects that were already underway before the legislation passed and would probably have gone ahead anyway.
All right, so let's follow up on that a little bit. Why? Why are investors deciding to go to places that were already developing pretty well and not going to those communities that this was designed for?
Well, it's because investors want to get the best return on their investment. And this whole program, you know, is market-driven. It's not a charitable giveaway. And so if you have money that you want to use this for, the places that you're likely to get the best return are the places that are already doing better. Places that are really economically deprived would represent a much riskier place to invest.
Right, give me some examples. Go ahead.
I think one thing I've heard as well is like real estate is very attractive early on in this incentive, because if you put $1 million into a real estate venture and it grows in value over 10 years to $500,000, that $500,000 is all free of the capital gains tax. And so that's pretty simple to understand for an investor. And you know the benefit is potentially huge. So for them to go to an area that's up and coming, that's kind of see a lot of activity in like a big city, that's sort of one of the biggest appeals, I would say.
Right, and the benefits are huge, but the investment itself has to make money.
Yeah.
And the more money the investment makes, the bigger the tax benefit is. But if you lose money on the underlying investment, then the tax benefits are irrelevant. So those kinds of equations, I think, are why some of these more deprived places have been struggling to attract investors.
All right, let's talk about some of the places where Opportunity Zones have not worked as well as what those communities would have liked. Where in Pennsylvania?
Well, for example, in my story, I mention Newcastle in Lawrence County, which is sort of a quintessential Rust Belt town. It has a declining population. The city itself is in Act 47 distressed status. And it's somewhere that could really use a boost. Now, Newcastle has a lot going for it. It has beautiful historic buildings. It has, people who live there and run small businesses. But it's not somewhere where real estate values are set to skyrocket over the next 10 years. And so if you're an investor and you get the same tax break for putting your money into an apartment building in a fast-growing Philadelphia neighborhood as you would into something in Newcastle, it's not hard to see why the Philadelphia investment might represent a better bet for you financially.
Mm-hmm. What about some other places in Pennsylvania that have benefited from it?
So I know the city of Coatesville in Chester County, they've seen some activity there. Interestingly, a startup company moving from the suburbs into the city. And that's something, we spoke a lot about real estate investments, which is really early on, I think, what the bulk of the money's been going into. you can also invest in businesses. And I think some people think that could sort of redeem some of these issues with the program that, you know, when you're not relying on real estate values increasing to make your money, maybe then you can be more flexible about, you know, it doesn't have to be somewhere that's going to grow that fast.
Mm-hmm. Ed, you looked specifically at the city of Erie. Why Erie?
They went pretty hard all in on opportunity zones very early. I talked to an attorney up there and some other business officials, and they recognized pretty quickly that the tax benefit of this and how it could really help a city like Erie that's been declining in population for decades. I think in 1960 or so, it had about 140,000 people. Now it's under 100,000. A lot of people kept bringing that fact up. It's on the mind of people in Erie. So they were, you know, they had been experiencing some economic decline. And so they were, I think, quick to jump at an opportunity like this Opportunity Zone.
Mm-hmm. And we're going to talk more about Erie because really it is an example of where Opportunity Zones have done well. As you said, they really jumped on it in Erie pretty quickly. We have a whole lot more to talk about in just a moment. You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. On today's program, during this portion of today's program, we're talking about Opportunity Zones. It's a federal program that was part of the 2017 tax cut program that came under the Trump administration and Congress enacted. Joining us on today's program is Charlotte Keith with Spotlight PA and Ed Mahan, where he reports for PA Post. And we're talking about these Opportunity Zones and those who have benefited and those who haven't. Charlotte, before we go any further, how were the cities and communities in Pennsylvania, how were they chosen? Who would be, as I mentioned earlier in the introduction, there's like 300 of them here in Pennsylvania. How were they selected?
Well, they were selected from a much bigger pool of places that were eligible. There were a couple different ways that places could qualify, but they basically had to be poor. And then it was up to the governor to choose to kind of winnow that number down. But the governor relied a lot on recommendations from local officials who know their communities best. So there was a sort of frenzied process last year where people were writing letters to the governor, suggesting census tracts and kind of making their pitch. And then the governor and the State Department of Community and Economic Development sort of made the final selection.
Now, obviously, this is not just a Pennsylvania program. 300 here in Pennsylvania, how many across the country?
Something like 8,700 plus. And different states, I think it's worth noting, have taken different approaches to how they picked these zones. I think Pennsylvania on the whole did target places that were distressed and had been struggling economically. Some states took very different approaches and concentrated more on places that were already on the upswing. Oregon famously designated almost all of downtown Portland, which is already somewhere that had been growing very fast. So some people say that, you know, when we're thinking about these investments, in one sense, it's not just that places in Pennsylvania are competing against other places in Pennsylvania, but that, you know, some investors take a national focus and they could really put their money anywhere.
That was my next question. I know that one of the goals here is to get local investors involved because, let's face it, they have more stake in these communities. But are there national investors that are investing here in Pennsylvania and vice versa?
There are some. There are a lot of big national funds that are very upfront about the fact that their approach is to find sort of the hottest opportunity zones and invest there. So they will say in their marketing materials, you know, we are going to use data and predictions to find like the top 10% of opportunity zones nationwide. There are places in Pennsylvania that might meet those kinds of criteria. And then obviously there are very many places that just wouldn't.
You said earlier that this program is not very transparent. Do we have any idea how much money has been invested in Pennsylvania or nationwide?
No, I don't think so. I don't think we have any clear
Not
idea.
Even a ballpark.
Don't guess, Ed. I can tell you about Erie, but I mean, even with I'm going to add a bunch of caveats too. But with Erie, there's we know about $13 million, specifically Opportunity Zone investment money that is being put into Erie. There's another big pool, about $47 million more in Erie, that's potentially up for grabs. That's the company Erie Insurance. It's a national company. They created a opportunity zone fund that's $50 million. The first $3 million of that is staying in Erie. The rest could go to any other opportunity zones across the country.
All right, so let's talk more about Erie. And as you suggested just a few minutes ago, Ed, that one of the reasons that you decided to report on Erie is because they were one of the first, and they were one of the communities that embraced opportunity zones so quickly, and they're relying on it a whole lot. Why have they been so eager? You describe the situation in Erie, but why has Erie been so eager to jump onto this program?
I think the biggest thing is like the manufacturing decline of where it was in the 60s. It's declined from there, which has led to a population decline, which has led to all sorts of economic problems, and it continues to have a population decline as well. I mean, the city has been on declining population, but most of Western PA the counties have been having a declining population as well. So Erie really thinks that they've been trying to reinvent themselves, and they see this as part of that.
You know, I have to say that a lot of times we here in the state capital, in eastern Pennsylvania, we don't hear a whole lot about Erie. I mean, there are some people who will say, well, Erie's closer to Canada than it is to Harrisburg. But one aspect of Erie that we have heard a lot about in recent years is the school district, that the Erie School District has been having a lot of financial problems. And I'm sure just from what you're describing, a lot of that has to do with this this population that is shrinking, businesses and industries that have left over the last 50 years. All these things are related.
Yeah, exactly. They're all connected. And those financial problems for the school district, I mean, it's pretty easy to see that as a symptom of these other problems as well, not just like that's the cause. And so in Erie, what they did is they, jumped on it early. The city of Erie worked to identify these eight census tracts that they thought would be the best places for these opportunity zones. They nominated them to the state. The state approved all eight of those census tracts. And in Erie, all of the opportunity zones in the entire county of Erie are all in the city of Erie. They're all relatively close together for Erie. They sort of range. There's some, there's some on like the West Bayfront Avenue that are like, they have big hopes for, more commercial properties, more, people who want to live near the waterfront. They see that as a potential benefit, but they also have it in, the east side neighborhoods of Erie where a lot of people don't own their own homes, and they're hoping that, through a combination of like public and private money through opportunity zones that would help boost home ownership.
I've heard many people say about Erie that Erie has some infrastructure, has some things going for it that a lot of other places, especially distressed places, don't have. The waterfront, Presque Isle State Park, that there has been some investment by Erie Insurance, as you mentioned. So when you were in Erie, I mean, are these things visible to the eye that you can look around and say, oh, here's an opportunity?
Yeah, and so the waterfront area, it's gorgeous over there. I didn't make it to the state park, but for next time I'll go out there. And then and Erie Insurance, when I was out there, they're working on like a $135 million construction project expansion. I think it's going to create like, several hundred, 600 new jobs in that area. So, I mean, Erie Insurance is a huge, huge benefit to that city. And it's a potential huge benefit for opportunity zones because a lot of these other cities in Pennsylvania don't have Fortune 500 companies.
And that is the only one in Erie.
The only one in Erie.
Right.
So it's in Erie's insurance's, self-interest, civic-minded goodness to have a thriving Erie city as well. So if they're they haven't said where the rest of they've created this $50 million fund. The first $3 million of that is going to, essentially a culinary arts district in downtown Erie. They want to have a public market, a food hall, a variety of chefs from diverse backgrounds. And so that obviously has a benefit, for the public good, but it also has a benefit for trying to attract employees to Erie Insurance.
Mm-hmm. Also tax benefits for the city itself, right?
Oh, exactly. And so one of the things with opportunities, we have a lot of, zone type benefit things in Pennsylvania, like Keystone Zone, all these other zone things. But the one thing that's, potentially good for Erie and, with opportunity zones is it's a federal tax benefit. It doesn't affect property taxes. So, if you increase the property value of this culinary arts district, the culinary arts district in Erie is like a 33 million plus project. So they're saying that will raise property taxes by like several hundred thousand dollars in Erie. And that's all money that, you know, helps this local school district, helps the county, helps the city.
Now, you mentioned that you did talk to some people in Erie. Set this up for us, if you will.
So I talked to John Persinger. He is the CEO of the Erie Downtown Development Corporation. He ran for mayor 2 years ago on the Republican side, ran a pretty close race there. And now he's been, you know, leading this effort in downtown Erie to create this culinary arts district. I went with him to sort of, you know, tour some of these dilapidated properties that they're trying to fix up.
We don't need 27. We need $127 million. Looking at these traditional economic development tools, they were not going to help us get there. Fortunately, Opportunity Zones came on the scene, and the great thing about them is it's not a government program. It relies on investors for when there are projects that are shovel-ready. We have shovel-ready projects now, so we need investment now.
Now, Ed, first thing I'm going to say is I heard that echo in the background. Describe this building that you were doing this interview in.
You know, this building was actually this is the office for the Erie
Downtown. Oh, okay,
yeah,
okay.
Before we headed over to this.
Because I saw some of the photographs story. Yeah.
Yeah. So this was this was like a building that they had fixed up as well. But this is where their office is now. And then after that, we walked over to this, you know, dilapidated building. There were boards with an orange H on them. That's for hole in the ground. And John told me those were actually the safe ones to walk on, somewhat counterintuitively, because they were newer boards. Some of the older boards could collapse underneath your feet. When we went to some of the upper levels, there were sections where there was like missing sections of floorboard. And there was, you know, the red dust from the bricks sort of falling off. Everything was sort of stripped off the walls. There was a Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles kiddie pool that was collecting water on one of the upper levels. There was a bin of dead birds that had been there for a long time when they got the building, and nobody really wanted to touch it. I guess someday they will. The building was in rough shape.
Yeah, that sounds like a perfect location for an opportunity zone. When you have a bin of dead birds, it sounds like a place that needs some help.
Yeah, and I think nationally people see that location and the potential there to turn it around as sort of like the best case scenario for these opportunity zones. I mean, because, you know, there are other, you know, similarly cities like York, Lancaster that have seen, you know, a resurgence in their food scene, essentially. So there is a potential in Erie, you know, based on just looking at some other smaller cities for that. But I guess the other thing there is not all of this is great news for everybody right now. I mean, this Culinary Arts District project, I think it's like five businesses have to move out. Like five businesses that are not in, you know, awful conditions in their buildings. That, you know, I went to a Thai restaurant. You know, it was crowded during lunchtime. It was a nice restaurant, but the Downtown Development Corporation, they say they have to make extensive renovations to all the buildings on the block. So these property owners have to, they're not property owners, they lease space there. And so their leases aren't going to be renewed. So that creates disruption for them, and they have to find new spots. And the restaurant owner I talked to, they looked in the city, they couldn't find a kitchen that was ready, you know, for them to go into. So they're moving to the suburbs.
But they are getting some help financially.
They created, and over the summer, the board for the Downtown Development Corporation created a $75,000 tenant assistance fund to, you know, help people who are being displaced because of this work.
So what challenges remain for Erie?
You know, I think there's still, I mean, you know, they've had some successes. They're still trying to raise more money. They're still trying to attract more investment. The other thing they got was there's the Culinary Arts District that is like the Opportunity Zone success example. And then there's a up to $10 million fund that would help business and tech startups in Erie. And that's sort of building off some things that were already happening in Erie. But it was an outside company based in Connecticut, saw an opportunity there as well. So they have to, you know, make those investments work out. And then they have to, you know, they have a lot of other projects they're hoping to invest in as well.
So what does Erie's situation and apparent success tell us about the Opportunity Zone program more broadly?
I would say it shows, one, the limits of the success, and two, how challenging the success is. I think yesterday, you know, as we were sharing our stories on social media, there was a economic development director in York who like pointed out that, you know, this, you know, good work for Erie, but this is really hard. This is hard to replicate for a lot of places.
Why?
One is, in Erie, everybody was sort of on board with this before the way they would put it to me is they were sort of on board with this just before Opportunity Zones were announced. They were looking for something, and this was sort of that something that they saw. And I mean, the other thing is, you know, Erie does have a lot of the advantages of Erie Insurance, the hoping to shift towards a more tourism-based economy. Charlotte, talks about some of these smaller communities. They just don't have the same level of resources at all.
You know, something I want to point out, you mentioned when we heard from John Persinger that he was a candidate for mayor. He actually is working with his opponent in the last election, which, you know, I know in your story there were a lot of people who pointed out that, this is the kind of cooperation that a community needs if they're going to be successful. And from what you just described, that sounds like something that other places need, maybe not two political opponents, but cooperation and a buy-in from everyone.
Yes, exactly. And yeah, so Democratic Mayor Joe Schember, he was, they ran against each other. I think it was considered the first competitive mayoral race in Erie's general election in decades. And so both of them are like sort of the two most visible people when you come to Opportunity Zones in Erie. Those are the two of the main first names you hear. And I talked to Rick Jacobs with Accelerator for America, who's working with cities across the country to, help them attract Opportunity Zone investment. And he was the one who really, thought that was noteworthy, thought that was interesting how closely they're working together.
Charlotte, the big thing that gets talked about when there is development in urban areas is gentrification. What did you hear across the state?
Well, yeah, absolutely. We have on the one hand these places that are saying we're not seeing any investment, and then other places that were already seeing investment, there are real concerns about gentrification and displacement. I think it's kind of interesting here to compare the approach that Philadelphia has taken to the one that Pittsburgh has. Philadelphia said, in choosing their zones, they tried to balance places that were really deprived with areas that were already on the upswing. And so I mentioned in my story this one renovation project in Brewery Town in Philadelphia. It's going to be a luxury apartment building. And that's the sort of project that a lot of people point to and they say, how does a luxury apartment building get to use a tax break that's meant to help poor communities? And it's an area where, gentrification has been talked about extensively over the past couple of years. There's still a lot of tension around it. And so that's something people, I think, are worried about. Pittsburgh, when they were picking their zones, they were very upfront that they were concerned about speculative pressure on vulnerable real estate markets. And so they say they purposefully chose zones that really were not seeing much interest already, which is, kind of a different approach. Philadelphia said they worried that if they only picked sort of the most depressed places, they would risk dampening investors' interest. But it's kind of interesting to look at those two cities, both places where people are worried about gentrification in some areas, and see how this kind of tool fits into that.
Ed, what about Erie?
In Erie, the example I offered earlier, the restaurant, the Thai restaurant owners who are being forced to move. I mean, some would see that as gentrification, as the displacement. In Erie, they created that $75,000 assistance fund to sort of help them. And I talked to the people leading the Development Corporation project. I mean, they see it as, people, these buildings are just in such bad shape that they can't stay. People can come back once they, fix everything up, was how they put it. But I mean, and I guess more broadly in Erie, I talked with Brett Weiler. He's sort of leading the effort to attract opportunity zones for all eight districts. And he sees the real true gentrification problems as something you see in like bigger cities with hotter markets like New York, Boston, San Francisco, and in Erie that they are so, that their main focus is trying to use this incentive to keep people there. And so they don't want anybody to leave Erie, and they need more people to come in to sort of save it, I guess, or to, restore it.
You've talked a couple times about transparency and how to measure whether these opportunity zones are actually working for what they're designed for. I don't know, maybe a few years down the road we'll have a better way of doing that. But Charlotte, how are people, after all this, how are people supposed to judge how successful opportunity zones are?
That's a good question. I mean, I think, you know, I spoke to like more than 30 economic development point people in these places that have opportunity zones. In some places, they're small enough that if there were new money coming in, they would almost certainly know about it. So when they say they're not seeing any investment yet as a result of this, they can be pretty confident in that. I think maybe the best way to think about it is look at how the program was designed. And, you know, a lot of the things that we're seeing now, it's not that these are surprising. These are things people have been worried about since the program was rolled out. These are things that, you know, experts have been pointing to as this will probably be an issue because it is so market-driven, investor-driven, and investors are going to put their money where they see the best opportunities, which aren't necessarily the places that need help the most.
Charlotte Keith is with Spotlight PA, an independent nonpartisan newsroom powered by the Philadelphia Inquirer. Ed Mahan reports for PA Post. PA Post is a statewide news digital first organization operated by WITF. You can read both their stories on opportunity zones and Erie in particular at papost.org. Thank both of you for being with us today.
Thank you.
Thank you.